Okay.
So tonight is January 10th, 2017, and I want to welcome everyone to the second half of this course. We have looked at a variety of ethical issues, but the ethical issues that we considered during the first half of this class were those that you might say were more political, perhaps, in nature, those having to do with communities, with nations, right? We looked at issues having to do with the whole world, issues where one's behavior could affect someone on the other end of the planet, and it really had to do with the question of preserving our society or our planet. Tonight, we're beginning a series of explorations into very personal ethical concerns. Tonight, as was already announced, we're going to take a look at end-of-life care, the ethics of end-of-life care, the ethics of setting up a durable power of attorney, or, in other words, a proxy, a healthcare proxy, someone to act on our behalf in the event that we can't. In subsequent weeks, we're going to be looking at issues like surrogacy, like enhancement, the ethics of enhancement. It sounds like it's a Henny Youngman joke or something. I mean, you know, listen, what could be so unethical about looking a little bit better, right? But seriously, there are a whole lot of issues that really have to do with us individually. And although, to a certain extent, we might say that these are interpersonal in some sense, interpersonal mitzvot, to a great extent, in the classical way in which we divide up mitzvot in the Jewish tradition, namely those between us and God or those between us and fellow human beings, you might argue that these really have to do with us and God in the classical division. What do I mean by that? Well, with end-of-life care, we have ethical issues, but they really are very, very personal in nature. What, for example, is the interpersonal ethics of a person deciding to end his life, for example? What's the interpersonal element of that? There might be one, but to a very great extent, we might say this has to do with personal autonomy and a sense of conscience, what we feel is right and what we don't feel is right. So tonight we're going to look at issues having to do with end-of-life care. Now there's a problem, you think about it, a natural, obvious problem with the topic of end-of-life care, which is what?
At that point.
How do you know you're at the end of life? You know, it's almost a riddle, because it reminds me of the famous passage in the Talmud by Rabbi Eliezer, which says you should repent the day before you die. So of course, we don't know the day that we're going to die, so therefore we should repent today. We should repent every day. Isn't that lovely? It's very nice. But when you get down to something a little bit more concrete, when is the care that I'm asking for, or when is the care that I'm providing to someone else end-of-life care? So what's the answer to that? Is there an answer to that? Yeah?
It's ongoing. It's something that you have to plan for now, but things might change.
Okay, so in the same way, so I just want to pull out one of the threads from what Laurie said, which is that in the same way that we should repent the day before we die, we should take care to address end-of-life issues today rather than tomorrow, because we don't know when we're going to die. That's true. So then the question, though, is, and let's say we do that. Let's say we should all do that. And by the way, we should all do that. The question, though, becomes, when have we entered that period that we would call end-of-life as opposed to life? Like, how do I know? Yes.
You may not know.
Right. You may not know. Okay. Yes.
And whose decision is it? The ill the person who is reaching the stage where they are at the end of life, or the relatives or caregivers? Because depending upon who defines it, you're defining who's right or who has more authority to weigh in on the choices.
Sure. So in other words, it may be subjective. It might be a little bit subjective. Like, you know, someone might say, we've reached the end of the rope for you. But a person may not feel that way. Or a person may feel, I'm at the end of my life. And someone else might say, no, you're not. And of course, you never know until afterwards who was, quote, right. But maybe it's not even accurate to say that. I'm going to pass around, and you should each notice these are not, they're not stapled so that you can put them in the three-hole binders that you have. They're sort of alternating up and down and left and right. So take a packet. This is the packet that comes with the course materials, okay? So we can just put one here and pass it one way, and here's another one. You could, you know, take pass it to you and then pass it around. Okay? That's the material that that comes with this course. And then I also decided to create a study packet of additional materials. And so, again, alternating vertical and horizontal, okay? And we'll take some here, and we'll take some here.
Let's go above or below.
I would say put my materials behind the course materials, okay? All right. So, so to get some sense about not only the confusion, but the sense of, not only the confusion about whether you're at end of life, but the confusion of how to respond to it, there's this, hi, come on in, please. We're going to begin by taking a look at this little essay, very short, by the late Rabbi Marshall Meyer. Has anybody here heard of Rabbi Marshall Meyer before? He was a truly gutsy, passionate social justice advocate. He was a rabbi, graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary. He was a follower of and a disciple of Abraham Joshua Heschel, moved to Latin America, moved to Argentina, and lived there during the very difficult time when people were being disappeared right and left. And he was a rabbi who was the rabbi of the journalist, you may have heard of him, Jacobo Timmerman, who was imprisoned. But there was no record that he was in prison. So Rabbi Marshall Meyer every day would go to the prison and would say, I'm here to see Jacobo Timmerman. And they would say, he's not here. And he'd say, fine, I'm going to sit and wait until I speak to him. And whether it was an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours, they'd bring him out, they'd talk, and then he would leave. And many think that it was because of his persistence that, in fact, Jacobo Timmerman remained alive. It was a terrible, terrible time. Anyway, eventually, in the, I think it was the mid-80s, he moved back to the States, moved to New York, and he resurrected, in essence, a shul, a large shul in the Upper West Side of Manhattan that was dying, and brought it back to life. And today, in his, he died not very long after that, actually, prematurely, and in his wake, his students and his disciples have actually continued to keep this as a very thriving, interesting, very creative shul called BJ. You may know that, B'nai Jeshurun on the Upper West Side. You heard of BJ? Okay. So let's just take a look at this. He's talking about this decision he felt he had to make with his brother. His brother was being cared for by his brother's dear friend, who was a physician. You see this? The first case study. And finally, one day, and this is the second paragraph, I said to him, Harvey, what on earth am I taking him to radiation for every day? He can hardly walk. Why are we doing this to him? This was his best buddy, he writes, from the time they were 10. He said to me, I can't stand not to do anything. I said, Harvey, it's not what you can stand. You're the doctor. It's what John can stand that counts. He's my brother. So he countered with a terrible question. He said, is that what John wants? Now, why is that a terrible question? It's a difficult question. It's a question that is very difficult to ask. It's very hard to ask somebody, is this what you want? And, you know, I've been in a situation where either I or others have asked someone or tried to ask someone that question. It's a very, very uncomfortable question. Why is it uncomfortable?
Because the person has to express their wishes, and they also have to face their own mortality to answer the question.
Okay. Anybody else? Yamita?
It could be perceived that you want them to answer in a certain way.
Okay. So then there's also that question of, is it a leading question? Like, aren't you ready to pull the plug now, Jerry? Okay. Or something like that.
Are
so there's,
you sure
there's
you
that
really
risk.
Want to do this?
Or are you sure you really want to do this and abandon me?
Yeah.
Right, so it's very easy to ask it in the wrong way. What else about it is tough? Makes it a tough or a difficult question? Yeah?
It's not that what makes it tough, because I think it's obvious what makes it tough in a lot of ways, how we want to express it. It's that who should ask the questions, it seems to me, should be only the person who's really facing the responsibility of being that person's key provider in the end.
So in this case, it's not that provider, but who is it that asks the question? It's Marshall Meyer himself. And in essence, you get the sense that at least informally, he was charged with responsibility for his care. In a sense, he was serving that role by getting the doctor.
Well, no, but he says he was the one who would dress him every day. So he was the caretaker, as I read it.
Yes, he was the caretaker, but did he have a durable power of attorney?
Oh, we don't know that.
Did he have a health care proxy? We don't know. But he clearly was playing this caretaker role.
Right.
And so, you know, he asked him. I asked my brother the terrible question. Notice he repeats it. The terrible question. It was an awesome moment. He knew that he was dying. Now, I know we can all say we're all dying. We're all a lot older than we were 10 weeks ago, 10 months ago, 10 years ago. We're all just getting more and more decrepit as time is going by. Yes, we're all dying, but we have a sense of what we mean by dying, don't we? And, in fact, there's a term that we'll get to a little bit later called active dying. Almost getting like a little joke. What, am I passively dying now and then I'm going to be actively dying? I'd rather be active something else now and maybe passively. No, so active dying is when there are certain physical processes going on that really seem to be moving a patient along, or a person who is a patient in some cases, to his or her demise. Yes?
And that could certainly be a conflict in this case. The doctor being...
A friend? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, no, the conflict being a doctor, where you're there to, I mean, you're taught to keep your people, you were taught to keep people alive and to do what you can, and being a friend, on the other hand, where you may not want to do everything that you can do.
Yeah, at least it seems that way, and certainly for the longest time it did seem that way. Although I think that there's some chinks in that over the last decade, for sure, there have been chinks in that divide or in that perception of conflict. And some would argue that, in fact, the role of the doctor has to be understood differently from the way it might have once been understood. Instead of the notion of preserving the functioning of every organ of the body, to caring for the patient. Yes?
Well, sometimes the person who's ill or dying brings it up themselves.
Yes.
But in this case...
In this case, it didn't seem that way, but what was interesting...
You know, that the caretaker brought it up. So, again, what was said about it being elite, you know, why didn't the brother say, I can't do this anymore, I'm so tired? You know, he doesn't indicate that his brother ever said that to him. Of course, when he said it to him, he said, I'm so tired, I don't want to do it anymore, but...
Now, the question you could argue might be a little leading.
Yes and no. I mean,
right?
You know,
John, this is so... But he doesn't go on. He doesn't finish that. He doesn't finish that thought. Do you want to do it? No, just leave me in my bed. You know what I want. Now, that's a very interesting statement. You know what I want. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But by saying that, and by the way, if anybody else had said, you know what he wants, it's not the same statement. But when that person himself, when the brother himself is saying, you know what I want, it takes on a certain quality to it. I just want some music. I just want to rest. Now, we're not going to be able tonight to sum up the whole development of the art of dying as it has been developed in the last couple of decades. I did make reference, you know, to the work of Atul Gawande in my last, on Rosh Hashanah a year ago already. We did have the conversation project that came. We've had a number of opportunities here in the shul to explore the importance of thinking about dying and what kind of dying we might choose for ourselves to the extent that we have a certain amount of, not control, but a certain amount of influence on that. So I don't think we need to spend that much time on this particular anecdote, but what I wanted you to understand is the point that the author wants us to make, which is what? If you had a chance. Anybody have a chance to look at this beforehand? If not, that's fine. But yes?
I think it is that...
And just speak up a little bit, Sue.
Okay, the question, it became difficult for Marshall Meyer to ask the question, but in some ways his brother may have wanted the question asked so that he could release him from...
Sure.
From the
sure.
responsibility.
Yeah.
One of the points that was made in the talk by Rabbi Springer
mm-hmm.
was that you can think you know what you want until you're faced with this reality, and that you can't just rely on an earlier conversation when you were much healthier.
Okay.
You've got to ask the question as somebody starts to fade a little bit and going through very painful experiences and say, now what do you think?
Right. So then let me just, that's a nice segue to the next question. And we're just going to do a little bit more of this, and then we're going to take a look at some text. 20 years ago, the notion was that if you want to help people as they're approaching the end of life, you help them to fill out a document called an advanced care directive or a living will. Such a document would set forth, this is what I want should I become incapacitated. This is what I want should I be confined to bed. Should this happen to me? And it's setting forth what you, as a person who's healthy and has full capacity, think you might want at a certain later point in time. In the literature of end-of-life care, living wills and advanced care directives are less sought after today. And what seems to be more sought after today is finding a person to act on one's behalf. A health care proxy. A health care proxy. Precisely because of the point that David is making. And it's very, very difficult to anticipate what you might want 20 years from now. It could be 25 years from now. You know, you might be doing your due diligence, but, you know, unless you're going to be updating your living will every year or so, and even then, you may not be able to update it at the time when it would really be helpful. But the real key question is, to whom would you entrust your care should you become unconscious? And someone would need to make decisions on your behalf. Such a person is called a proxy, an agent in Jewish law, or the possessor of a durable power of attorney. It's someone who can act on your behalf. Why is that? Why do you think that tends to be more sought after today?
More pliable.
What were you going to say, Heidi?
I was just going to say legal reasons.
Yeah, legal. Yeah, well, law does have a lot to do with all of this. But that actually introduces a certain complication. And it's the complication that actually Michal Springer spends a lot of time on in her little talk. The complication is this. I know what it means when someone writes on a piece of paper, I want you to not resuscitate me should X, Y, and Z happen. You can interpret that. It's very different to say, I know what he would have wanted, even though I have no evidence of that. I have no written evidence of that. So it's a much it requires much more intimacy, intimate knowledge of a person, right? Because a durable, you know, if you have that proxy, you can make determinations of life or death for a person, and you have no, there's no need to actually point to a document that says that's what Bernie would have wanted.
Take more responsibility on that.
It takes a grave, great deal of responsibility, and it's a grave responsibility. Let me just mention, Rabbi Michal Springer grew up in the Boston area. I think she lived in Newton. She went to the Schechter School.
Oh.
She then went to Yale, went to JTS, and I was a student at the seminary with her. We studied Hebrew grammar together. She's very good at biblical Hebrew grammar. And she pursued hospice work upon graduation, and now she runs the field education and hospice care and pastoral care, clinical pastoral education program at the Jewish Theological Seminary. And what she really focuses a lot of attention on is this notion that if you really want to be an effective advocate for a person, you really have to know what that person wants. And what does that require? It requires you to have conversations with that person. It really requires you to get a sense of what that person wants. Now, it's at that point when I listened to the talk that she gave and I reviewed the text that we have here, that I felt that there was something missing from this material. What would you say from having, if you had a chance to listen to her videotape, what would you say was the prevailing ethical concern that she pointed out in her talk? Anybody who was able to see it. I mean, think about it for a moment. The talk is about the ethics of this relationship with one's healthcare proxy. Yeah?
Well, the example she gave was her mother who had Alzheimer's, and she seemed happier to her in this condition than she had.
Okay, let me freeze it. Her mother made certain statements about what kind of care she would or wouldn't want should she become demented. She then proceeds to become demented, and the assumption being that she was going to feel X, Y, and Z, and lo and behold, she begins to feel differently from the way everyone predicted she would feel. She seems to look happier, and she seems to be happier, which would suggest perhaps that some of the statements she had made before might no longer hold, right? She might be happy with her life. And by the way, I've seen this myself, that sometimes, you know, someone is in a physical state where you might say, oh, gee, if I were in that state, I'd be really unhappy, and I wouldn't want to live that way. And the person seems very content. And not only that, seems very placid. Yeah?
But if it's documented...
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of how the person appears to be, you know, which is very objective, maybe the person's not even communicating, the question arises, well, you know, that person has requested this, this, and this, and I see it a little differently. Should I follow their wishes, which are legal, or take it upon myself because I know this person
better than anyone. Yeah, so let's leave aside for a moment the legal concern. Not to say that there aren't legal concerns, but just to remind everyone, what we're going to focus on, what we are focusing on in this class are ethical concerns, and not just any ethical concerns, Jewish ethical concerns. We really are interested in getting a sense of what the Jewish ethical response would be for a particular situation. And I think you pointed out beautifully that the fact that, you have something on a piece of paper, and that piece of paper does say something, even though conditions may have changed, you think a person's will might have changed, but still, you have it, for sure, you have what's down on that piece of paper. Yes? Which is a wonderful segue to the next text we're going to look at, but please, Wendy.
This may be going into the legal again, but I think in order to understand what you're seeing in front of you, or both times, you have to know whether the person is competent, whether they know what's going around, or whether the happiness is something that they're not aware of, and it's a neurological expression of.
Absolutely correct. And by the way, in the actual lecture that Rabbi Springer gives, she tells what happened, which is that she decided to ask her mother. Yeah, it's a very touching kind of a little moment, because she actually, again, your assumption reading it is, well, her mother is in such a state she's not going to be able to respond to it. Well, she does respond to it. She says, "Oh no, I still believe what I used to say. I'm ready to die." Mm-hmm. Very interesting statement. Okay, so I want to come back to this notion that, you know, things may have changed, and then what? Now, to just capture, and this might seem like a very far-fetched analogy. I think it is a little far-fetched, and it might be complicated, but we're going to take a look at it anyway. It's a text that is in the packet, and it might introduce something that brings something to mind. It's text number 2 in our list of, you know, decision-making, absence and presence. Okay. It's a complicated text. Basically, it says, you know, let's say that someone has authorized the divorce of his wife. Now, this is Talmudic period. You can authorize, and so therefore, here you've got this person carrying this authorization to divorce his wife, okay? And going to perhaps another city where the wife lives, okay? And then, before it gets delivered, because once it's delivered, it's done. Before it gets delivered, the man has second thoughts. So he sends a second agent to countermand the first agent and to change the result. Like, no, I changed my mind. Okay, that's the hypothetical. So what happens when they both get to the destination? And the second agent says, you know, he changed his mind. He doesn't want to go through this divorce. That's case number 1. Okay? Case number 2, a man decides, you know, his faithful servant has been working for him for 10 years. It's time to let him go free, to be a free citizen in the ancient world. So he sends an agent to free him. And after a day or so, the man is on the way, presumably. He has second thoughts. And he realizes, you know, I've been enjoying him bringing in my coffee, doing the dishes, making the beds. I think I want to keep him a slave. Okay? So I'm going to countermand that emancipation proclamation that I just issued a couple of days ago. Sends another agent to catch up with the first one. Okay? So, Does it work in either or in both or in neither case? What's the law? So the law in the Mishnah is very, very clear. When it comes to the divorce, the second agent overtaking the first countermands and basically takes precedence over the first agent. That divorce doesn't go through. But in terms of the authorization to free the slave, once someone has authorized the freeing of the slave, the second agent has no effect. What's the difference between the two? And even to answer the question requires you to put yourself in the mindset of the Talmudic rabbis as opposed to today. That's one of the challenges of a text like this. We went over that first semester. They're not so easy. So what can you say about, let's look at the easier of the two cases, the freeing of the slave. Okay? Maybe, let's say the first agent has just gotten there, okay? And you've got this piece of paper that says, I hereby declare you free! And then the second agent arrives. Sorry, it's all over. No, you're still a slave. The notion of that is that you can't change your mind on something like that. Why? Why? Yeah?
Because freedom is a human right.
Well, it'd be nice to say it's a human right, but then everybody would be free, right? But
right.
Not everybody
but
is.
But in this case, I mean, yeah. The first one said, you're free, and it seems to me, you can't take that back.
You can't take it back. It's clear to all of us today that that's the preferred state to be. And so you can't then sort of take back that elevated state.
Does it matter whether it's been announced or just handed to the agent?
I had a feeling you were going to ask that question.
In your example, that he's announced it, but doesn't even require that.
Even if you don't have that situation, the fact is that the notion is that his rights vested
immediately,
in essence,
no back season.
As soon as it.
Not on that.
Right.
Not on that. But when it comes to the divorce, and this is again, I'm actually not apologizing for it because it's not. Not for me to apologize or not apologize for it, but I want everybody to be aware of it. In the rabbinic understanding of the status of a woman after divorce versus the status of a married woman, the divorced woman does not get support other than a particular sum of money that's paid to her when the ketubah is presented, whereas a wife is entitled to a certain amount of economic support. The notion is it's for her own good not to be divorced. So therefore, that is permitted to be reversed. That's in their imagination. I do want to move on to the healthcare case, but you have a hand.
Just quickly, I don't know, I haven't studied the history of this time, but I can imagine an argument to say there could be a context where the slave is actually better off provided for economically and all that stuff.
And you don't think there, but you could have the same things stated for the case of a person who's in an abusive relationship, right? It might be better to be divorced, right? So there clearly are going to be particular cases that will be contrary to the default. So what we're really studying here is just what is the default? And the principle of the default is that if the will has been expressed and the change of the will is not for the benefit of the person, but for his or her detriment, okay, then that will determine whether or not it will be allowed to come into force. Okay, just a few quick questions of clarification, then we're going to move on. Wendy,
they're making assumptions.
Of course. Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, the fundamental assumption is that in that society, a woman is better off being married, being supported. A slave is worse off being a slave than being a free human being. Those are the two assumptions, essentially. Yeah.
No, I just, as we were talking about the issue with the slave, it was almost, I can see where the rabbis would be in favor of not taking it back, because it almost sounds like the story that we're about to be in the Torah in the next few weeks is Pharaoh's willfulness about agreeing to
let him go and then take him back. Very nice, very nice. Exactly. Absolutely.
We shouldn't be acting like Pharaoh.
Okay, so the idea is, absolutely, very well done, well done. The idea is that, there are serious consequences. So what's the application of this principle to the whole issue of creating a proxy or creating a durable power of attorney? Let's say that someone has made a certain determination, okay? I want, for example, extraordinary measures taken should I lose this capacity and lose that capacity and lose the other capacity. And you entrust the decision-making to an agent, and then time goes by, and then the person does enter into that state. And the question is, can he change his mind? Can the agent change the mind of the patient? What kind of changes are permitted? It comes back to what Hillary's comment was, which is, can we make this change or not? Even if, we get over the question of whether we know what the patient wants or the person wants, even if we get to that, we say, I know that he or she wants this. Can I change things at that late stage? It's different, on the one hand, to say, I know this document says that he wanted extraordinary measures. I'm going to tell you now that he just told me yesterday he doesn't anymore. That's one possibility. The other possibility is somebody 20 years ago said, just let me go, and then 20 years go by, and said, you know something? Yesterday he just told me, do everything you can to keep my organs alive. Okay. So this is the ethical dilemma that is explored in the materials that are prepared in this packet. But as I was reading this and studying with you, it just seemed to me irresponsible not to look at a couple of texts about the substantive Jewish ethical law, if you will, of end-of-life care. In other words, there are texts in our tradition that set forth what is understood to be proper versus improper care at end of life. So, I would like, with your permission, actually even without your permission, I would like to take a few moments and to look at some fundamental, basic Jewish texts so that we understand what are, in the Jewish tradition, the ethics of end-of-life care, leaving aside these issues of agency. Yes?
Are these ethics man to God, God to community?
That's an excellent question, and I was sort of getting into that at the very beginning. Let me leave the question open and ask you and others here to try to answer that question as we study the material. Okay? That's a great question. I, by the way, think that in many, many cases, that dichotomy is a troubling one. You know, I mean, many people, for example, see kashrut as between us and God, let's face it. But you know something? If you know something about what kashrut is supposed to do in terms of our consciousness vis-a-vis animals, as we looked at it last term, you would might say it's about us and other creatures, if not human creatures. Similarly with some of the material here. So, I just prepared for you a couple of texts, and they focus on three specific questions. Okay? Yes?
All this Jewish ethical stuff, respect, and feeling nice, like, I never even knew all about this until I came in here.
Uh-huh.
But what good is it if you're in a situation, you know, like doctors have their jobs, they know the protocol, whatever.
That's an excellent question.
Bring it up and say, well, you know, according to the Jewish ethics, you know, where are you getting that from?
Well, I think what we're seeing today in end-of-life care is a great deal more attention paid to the value systems that human beings live their lives according to. And it's certainly the case that in any good palliative care institution or a unit, the first question is, you know, what is it? What is the system? What is the cultural system? Or what are the cultural assumptions of this person and or his or her family and community regarding what's proper and what's improper? Those are the first questions that are asked.
Which were never asked a few years ago.
They may not have been asked a few years ago. I don't know one way or the other, but I will say that that's happening now. I was speaking with the head of the palliative care at Hebrew Senior Life about this exact question. And, you know, when they have certain patients who are from an Orthodox Jewish community, they ask them certain questions, and some other people are from a more liberal Jewish community. Others may not be Jewish at all, and they come from different places, and they therefore understand what is happening differently, because it isn't just a clinical state. It isn't just a description of certain dying, as we will see. And death is not just a physical process. It's an interpreting process. It's how it's understood that's the real key. And so what I'm suggesting, and this is why I felt the need for these texts, I think it's really important for us to have a sense of what the Jewish ethical assumptions are about end-of-life care. Okay? So I'm looking at three questions. I should tell you, by the way, that when I teach this in other contexts, it is either 2 hours or it's 4 hours to go through this material. I teach at the Hebrew Senior Life, I teach the chaplains once a year, a unit on end-of-life care, and we spend a lot more time than we have time for tonight, but these are good texts, and I think we can get the key points out of them very, very easily.
Which is the same amount of material, or there's more material to spend with that?
There's about the same amount, about the same amount. So the first unit, can one, and I might have entitle it, can, should not one withhold treatment from the dying? But the key presenting question is, can one? I.e., is it ethical to do so? The second unit is, can one hasten one's own death or that of another? We'll take a look at a few texts there. And the third is, can one pray for death? See them? Okay. So, I thought that the first one was worth looking at. Now, this is a text from the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, we looked at, I think, a text from the Shulchan Aruch last semester, is a medieval code of Jewish law. It's really a digest. It consists of little snippets of law, the fuller expatiation of which is in Rabbi Yosef Cairo's commentary on the Torah, which is a much longer work. But it has taken its place as really the definitive source of Jewish legal material. And there is a section of Yoredeia, which is the laws of dying and of mourning. And we see this there. Now, by the way, where did Yosef Cairo live? Well, he lived in the city of Tzfat, in the Near East. Okay, the city of Tzfat is in what we today call Israel. Okay, he was a Sephardic Jewish legal authority. So while the Shulchan Aruch is being published, it's being published from the perspective of Sephardic Jewry. Within a decade or so, a gloss, a collection of glosses, a collection of little responses to almost the entire Shulchan Aruch was written in order to make it applicable to European Jewry, who are known as Ashkenazim. Okay, so just keep in mind, by the way, we might have a very Eurocentric view of the world, but the Shulchan Aruch is a Near Eastern text. And by the way, the word Shulchan Aruch means the set table. Okay? So the commentary that we're going to see below by Rabbi Moshe Isserles is called, what do you think it's called? Hamapah, meaning the tablecloth. Okay? So we've got the Shulchan Aruch, which is the set table, and then we have the tablecloth. By the way, that's a cute way of Ashkenazim, you know, asserting their sort of superiority, you know. All right, this is the set table. Now we're going to put the tablecloth on top, and you'll understand. But seriously, there are two different, you know, cultural systems. Let's first look at what Yosef Cairo has to say. He talks here about the laws of the goses. Now, what is a goses? In the medieval period already, the rabbis, and it isn't just because they were rabbis, it's clearly because within their society they recognized that human beings can sometimes become ill. And sometimes they become ill and begin the process of dying. When Gesundheit. By the way, we say Gesundheit because in the medieval world, the notion was that they sometimes believed that the soul exited the body through a sneeze. And in fact, and this is very in keeping, I'm very glad you, if you don't mind my paying attention to this, but, you know, we have the patriarch Jacob is described in this past week's Torah portion as becoming ill. And according to the Jewish tradition, he's the first person in the world to become ill. Before then, people didn't get ill. So the question is, how did they die? They sneezed. And that is how their souls exited the body. But now we don't do that. Now we have this privilege. Now we have this privilege of getting sick. And therefore, in essence, getting a little bit of warning sometimes. Okay, so it's a little bit of a midrash there. But the notion is that sometimes you're entering this state where you become a goses. A goses is a moribund person. A person who is dying. And what does that mean, dying? That means that 3 days from now, that person will not be alive. 72 hours. That's what it was understood to mean in the medieval period. Whether it means that today is another whole very serious question. But in those days, that's what it meant. In fact, in order to fit all of these texts on these pages, I cut out some of the Shulchan Aruch, subsection 1. And in a later text, what it reads is that if you hear that someone is a goses, okay, and then you don't hear anything else about him, 3 days later, start saying Kaddish. That's a very, very shocking statement considering what we're about to read. Okay? So a goses is what? A dying person whose death you anticipate within 3 days. Okay? So look what they teach us about the ethics of caring of a goses. The goses is like a living human being in all respects. Comment?
It is a human being.
Okay, I'm very glad you commented that. Because there's one letter in the Hebrew text that can be translated as like. The word is kit. And this is the accurate way of translating this text. But this text, this sentence contains a contradiction. Either a goses is a living human being in all respects, or a goses is like a living human being in all respects. Meaning that a goses is not like a living human being in all respects. So I think you capture that confusion with that statement, frankly. Or not the confusion, perhaps, the ambiguity. So listen to what they say. And I apologize if this is graphic. But it is graphic. Because we're talking about dying. And if you're talking about dying, the way that the text wants to talk about dying is to talk about what happens after dying. What happens after dying? Death. After dying comes death. Once death occurs,
after
the remains...
Dying, isn't dying death?
No.
Well, that's the process of dying.
The process of dying concludes
with
death. And following death, there are certain responsibilities and obligations that we have toward the remains, the mortal remains of a person. And that's how the text chooses to talk about how we should treat the goses. Listen. The goses is like a living human being in all respects. One does not tie up his jaw or anoint him or stretch out his limbs or stuff up his orifices. One does not remove the cushions from beneath him or place him on sand or on clay or on the earth. One does not place on his belly neither a bowl nor a spade nor a dish of water nor grains of salt. I'm sure this is capturing for you the procedures that were followed following death. Okay? One does not give notice about him in the towns, nor does one hire professional funeral wailers. Now, you might say to yourself, you know, he's about to go. There's this guy with a really great voice in the next town who is really... Actually, there were women who were called... Mekonanot were called wailers who were paid to come to funerals and wail. This was part of the culture at the time, okay? Maybe I should hire them already because someone else might snatch them out from under me. Do we do that? No. No, we don't. Nor does one close his eyes until when? Until his soul departs. Any questions about this? These are things you do to a body after the body has become a body. Okay? And anyone who closes the eyes, and this is for David's benefit, as the soul is departing, spills blood, meaning is guilty of murder. So the notion is, no, dying has to conclude before you treat the person as a body. Okay? And one does not make a tear in one's garment. That's a Jewish practice. I'm sure that most of us are familiar with that. It used to be done on clothing by everyone. Now, liberal Jewish communities, many people tear a ribbon, but they wear the ribbon as a sign of mourning, the ribbon with the tear. One does not make a tear, nor does one remove him, meaning remove the body, nor does one eulogize over him, meaning we don't use the past tense. We don't use the past tense. Okay? And one does not begin reciting Siduk Hadin, which is part of the burial ritual. It's a liturgical piece that justifies the judgment until the soul departs. Okay? Now, yes?
Sorry. When does one know when the soul departs?
we'll leave that aside for a second. Okay? Leave it aside. But one thing is clear. When someone is a gosses, which means the person is breathing, the person's heart is beating, but that person is dying, one is not there yet. Okay? We're not going to talk in great detail at all about definition of death, because that can get us delayed. But I will say a few words about it. David and then Hani.
For an Orthodox or traditionally religious Orthodox Jew, when there's a burial ceremony, do they have to separate men and women at the burial ceremony too?
That's a separate question. And
you're talking about the whalers and the woman whalers. I was
yeah, and the answer is it depends.
Okay.
Heidi.
Some of this reminds me of practices that some people have of not setting up a baby's room until the baby is actually born.
Yeah, there is a difference. There is a difference between the two. In one case, my sense is that not setting up the baby's room comes from a superstitious place, okay? And, you know, and by the way, I knew I shouldn't have done that. I cut out another little snippet from this exact text, from the next text, that we're going to study, which captures that superstition. When Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was dying, and we're going to study that in a moment, the rabbis put out an edict. Anybody who says that he's dying or that he's died, it's not clear what they really are saying there, should be put under the bed. And the notion being that saying something like that makes it happen. Mm-hmm. Similarly, the idea is that if you set up a baby's room, you're tempting the evil eye. Okay. Now, this is different in the following sense. A person remains a subject as long as a person is alive. Only once a person dies does the body become an object. So we're really talking about the transition from a subject to an object. Wendy.
Just so when you do the prayers, which I think is a profound amount, like a confessional, yes. Like how do you know the judgment is doing, like the right time to do that?
The answer, that's a great question. There is a Jewish custom when someone is dying of offering the person to do what's called the vidui, or the confessional, or one can recite it on that person's behalf. And one is told, and this is another section of the Shulchan Aruch that we're not going to read tonight, that you should assure people, many people have confessed and then lived for many, many years later, and others have died without confessing. So the notion is that it's never too early to do it. It's only, on occasion, too late. So you can confess one day, and then you're alive the next. Oh, I'll recite the confession again. So that's the answer. The answer is that it's a way of bringing a certain kind of solace to a person and to his or her family. Yes?
Is there, I recall some sort of tradition too of changing in a person's name.
Yeah, that's related to what Heidi was saying before. There is a practice, I won't say a superstitious practice, but it is a superstitious practice, of adopting a name, and often the name is what? If it's a man, for example. Chaim. Adopting the name Chaim, or changing the name. Why? To confuse the Malach HaMavet, to confuse the angel of death, because the angel of death comes, he's got on his paper, I'm looking for Irving. He gets here, is there Irving here? No, this is Chaim. Oh, I got to go to the next room. It sounds silly to us, but it's not silly to people who believe this, that, that in a sense, you are the appointed one, And by the way, I think it was a Twilight Zone episode that kind of captured this very, very nicely. Because that's actually one morality play after another. It's fantastic, fantastic. But that's the origin of that practice. It's clearly a superstitious practice. Okay. Okay. Can we move on back? So we dealt with Sephardic tradition. The concern of Rabbi Yosef Cairo is don't treat a dying person as if the person is already dead. That's the major concern. Now let's look at what the concerns. How the concerns, that same concern, in essence, how it's expressed in Ashkenaz by Rabbi Moses Isserles. Okay? He goes on first, and it's starting to sound just like what we've read before. And there are those who say, do you see where I'm reading from? That one does not mark out a grave for him, even though it isn't there with him in the home until after he dies. Okay, so in other words, you're taking care of someone, the person is dying, You don't say, excuse me, I just got to go outside for an hour or so and start shoveling a grave. You don't do that. Now, why? It's not right there. The person may not see it. What's the reason you wouldn't do that? Why not use it? Why not use that time? Right? What's wrong with that? Why not? Yeah. Sure. Well, in fact, one other section that I removed in the interest of space did say that, in fact, when someone is dying, you don't leave the person. You don't leave the person because a person should not die alone. It's a very, very powerful statement. Okay, so that's one good answer. Now we get to something that does not exist in the Sephardic text, but it does exist in this Ashkenazi text. And it's two paragraphs. The top one, and it is forbidden, and the next one, okay? And it is forbidden to cause a dying person to die more quickly. It's forbidden to hasten death. Okay? Get that. It's forbidden to hasten death. That's a very important Jewish principle. There are two Jewish principles having to do with end-of-life care that you need to remember. One of them is, thou shalt not hasten death. Now let's see what that means. It's forbidden to cause a dying person to die more quickly. For example, concerning someone who is a gosses for a lengthy period of time and yet whose soul is unable to depart. There was a mythology about this. Let's say someone is dying and they're dying and they're dying and they're not dying. What's happening here? Let's see. It's forbidden to remove the pillows and cushions from beneath him on the assumption that there are a few feathers there that are causing this. The notion was there's something bothering this person that's holding on somehow, that's preventing him from dying, okay? But I don't want to use that word preventing it because it's going to come up in the second paragraph. And so one does not move him from his place, and so one is forbidden to place the keys to the home of a gosses beneath his head in order that his soul should depart more rapidly. That seemed to be something that would speed someone along. My keys are here. I'm ready to go. By the way, not as far-fetched as you should think. Where are my keys?
It could be like the car keys to a really great car.
It could be. It could be. But let's look at this next paragraph. Because this next paragraph is, you must read the second paragraph together with the first. And together form a theology, if you will, or a morality of end-of-life care. Here's the last paragraph. But, and I put this, the italics are mine, okay? If there is something that is causing a hindrance, if there is something that is hindering, actively hindering dying to death, and the Hebrew is shegorem ikuv, to the departure of the soul, if there's something that's keeping this soul from doing what it wants to do, such as when in the vicinity there's a loud, incessant noise, such as that of a woodchopper. The notion is, there's somebody out there chopping wood. And, you know, the person is hearing it. Okay? And the notion is, that's keeping that person alive. One sec. Okay, that's the hindrance. Okay? Or, where there is salt on the tongue, and the salt is actually, there, you know, I don't know the physiology of what would lead to the creation of salt deposits under the tongue, but somehow that's preventing the soul from departing. Then it is permitted to remove them. For this is not an affirmative act, ein baze ma'aseh klal, rather one is removing an impediment. So, if the first principle, and I do want to come back to Laurie, because she had a question. If the first principle is thou shalt not hasten death, the second is, however, what? One must not prolong dying. So you have these two very different expressions of concern for a dying person. On the one hand, you must not hasten death, but you must not prolong dying, which means that if there is an impediment to dying, one, you could argue, not just may, but perhaps must remove that impediment. Now,
distinguishing between them is kind of...
Distinguishing between them requires you to get some rabbinic consultation, right?
The
yes.
Feather, the
here.
How do you
I'm sorry, I do want to... I did say to Laurie that I would call on her. So first Laurie and then Peter. Yes.
So I was thinking, so when someone...
A little louder, Laurie.
When someone is dying, sometimes a family member will say to the person, it's okay for you to go home.
Yes.
So is that... Would that be an...
Great question. Hold that question. In other words, is the granting of permission to one's relative to die, is that removing an impediment to death, or is it hastening death? Great question. Peter.
How do you square all of this with, unfortunately, modern medicine?
Okay, that's a great question. Great question. Next question.
You're doing a great job answering it.
We will address these two questions. These are terrific questions. Wendy?
I was going to just say, like, it's a great line, because I know we went through it this summer with, like, you continue dialysis because it's, like,
yes.
Continuing, is it giving you a better quality of life, or should you stop it because it's going to hasten your death? You don't get it.
It's, the question is keeping machine X on, mm-hmm. or is giving treatment Y to this patient prolonging the dying process? Gee, if it's prolonging dying, then it might be that it's actually forbidden. Okay? It's a very curious question, though, because sometimes there are therapies that are offered in order to care for a patient. And one might say that they are actually designed to prevent death from occurring. Yes?
None of the examples, either affirmative or negative, deal internally with what's going on. The pillows, the saw, the wood chopper, it's all external, one way or another. So,
great, great distinction.
So the question is any of this relevant
great.
To today?
Sure, and I would argue that it is, but how it's relevant is not clear, and how different rabbinic authorities interpret the application of these texts today is a very interesting subject, right? I mean, the question is, if one is giving dialysis to a patient whose all of whose organ systems are failing, is that preventing the death, or is it prolonging the dying? What will happen eventually? Will this patient recover? And that seems to be the key, you know, question that allows one to apply these texts to modern day therapies. If the most favorable outcomes occur, what will happen? Okay? Will this patient begin, for example, breathing on his or her own? If, for example, a patient has no chance of breathing on his or her own when that machine is withdrawn, may that machine be withdrawn? That's one of the key questions that is asked. And by the way, I've been with patients when the machine is turned off. And by the way, it's a scary thing sometimes because a person can seem to be breathing on his or her own for a little bit. You think, gee, the doctor just said that person cannot breathe on his or her own. What's happening? And sure enough, it stops. But, you know, gee, what do we know about that? Was the doctor right? Was the doctor wrong? The fact is that there are ways of applying these texts. I didn't say it's easy, and I didn't say it's clear, and certainly different authorities will differ. I just ordered a book of a Jewish medical ethics book today because these kinds of issues are continually being explored. You know, this is like a key question across the board, no matter what one's religious denomination within Judaism. These are key ethical questions. Where does, you know, what therapies fall in which category and what therapies fall in another category? Yes, Kenderson.
And then in the situation of we have more and more interfaith families, mm-hmm. and so different belief systems come into play,
mm-hmm.
and in the case of Christian scientists who don't believe in any medical intervention or very little medical intervention, you know, it's like one continual minefield after another, it seems like.
I think you're right, and in fact, as we know, you know, even within the Jewish community, there are wide ranges of beliefs and of commitments and of loyalties, which goes to show that when we're choosing a healthcare proxy, we should choose someone who really is going to try to match our own sensibilities about this. But that statement makes an assumption. That statement's assumption is that personal autonomy is the key ethical issue here. And that's what I found a little bit troubling by the way that Rabbi Springer had presented the materials, because I think in the Jewish ethical tradition, there are other factors other than one's own autonomy. That one's own autonomy is in fact limited, and she knows this. I mean, it's like I'm not teaching her anything. It's just that it wasn't made clear in the materials that one's own autonomy is limited by certain Jewish religious principles, Gesundheit, such as the notion that one may not hasten death. One may not hasten death. So that's actually an important constraint. So if a person should say, I am making the decision that I want to, perhaps, I want not only to withdraw care, I would like to take 800 of these pills and terminate my life. May I do so? Well, not so clear that that's permissible according to Jewish laws. We'll see, it's not as clear that it's not permissible, but that is certainly a limitation, potentially a limitation on one's own personal autonomy. Yes, Mita?
So supposing somebody is in a situation in hospice, and supposing they have the ability to regulate the amount of painkiller mm-hmm. they take.
Yes.
To keep their pain
right.
at a manageable level.
Yeah.
If they take high levels,
right.
that might shorten their life.
Yeah.
How does this...
Yeah, so there's a very...
There
are very specific answers that I can give to that question. Is everybody understand the question? Mm-hmm. The question is very simple. Certain pain-killing medication has the effect, or you might say has the side effect, of diminishing respiration and possibly, maybe not just possibly, but making the possibility of continuing one's life less likely. So in such questions, so one question is, what is one's motivation? What is the purpose of the therapy? If one is taking the therapy to relieve pain, does in fact, and the subsequent possible side effect is that it may in fact diminish one's chances of living by a certain amount or speed the dying process, is that permitted? One analysis would go that the issue is, what is one's intent? Okay, that's one clear analysis, and in fact, sometimes someone may say, "I'm taking this to diminish my pain," but one's intention may be, "I want to terminate my life," and so often the issue of intent is the key decisive issue in most analyses. There's a technical way of talking about that. If you shoot me an email, I'll send you a whole discussion about this exact point by Elliot Dorff in his work in which he has a whole chapter devoted to end-of-life care. Now, I do want to come back to a comment of Laurie that she made. She asked a question, right? What happens when a person says, you say to your relative, it's okay, you can die. First of all, is that permissible? You might say, you should say, no, you can't die. Forbidden. Can't do it. Right? I mean, you could make that argument. Is it hastening death to do so? Is it, in fact, allowing, removing an impediment to dying? Yes.
When I was at the hospice, they said that it's, you want the person to be comfortable at the end of their life, so you want to release them from, mm-hmm. Just say it's okay to go.
It's hard for me to see it as anything but removing an impediment, but I have to say that you could at least imagine in some cultural systems, and there might be some Jewish cultural systems, where that would seem pasnished to say to someone. You could certainly imagine that. Carol, I want to move to a text that will help illustrate this. Yes.
I was told by the chaplain at the Hebrew Rehab when my mother, who was almost 101, was passing away, that what you ought to say is, we love you, you took care of us wonderfully, we will be okay without you. We hope you live, but it's okay if you die. And I was specifically told that, and I think it brought my mother a great deal of peace, because she passed away after lingering on for days the next afternoon.
Yeah, I mean...
And I was shocked when I first heard it, and she had to tell it to me twice over 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
But then I could understand what you were saying. You weren't saying, leave.
Right.
We're tired of this agony. You were saying, it's okay, Mom. Your responsibilities are over now.
I want to give a little bit of support to this interpretation. I'm over intellectualizing by sort of presenting the whole range of possibilities, but I want to read with you a text that I think makes it clear that in the Jewish tradition, this is in fact the proper way to behave, and in fact we should allow people. You know, death is a journey, or I should say, dying is a journey, in fact, the notion is that we want to remove impediments. When you go on a trip, it can be very uncomfortable. And the idea should be it should be as comfortable as possible on this trip. And if there's anything we can do, that's fine. On the other hand, you don't want to say, you know, the train's leaving in 5 minutes. Get out the door, you know. So there's that issue, okay? So the text I want to share with you is a text which is section 3. And the explicit question that I put there, you see Roman numeral 3, you'll pardon the expression, Roman numeral 3. I don't like to use Roman numerals because what do we like from the Romans, right? And they weren't very good to us, but that's what we have. We have Roman numerals. Can we pray for death? And I put the question there. The question is not part of the Talmudic story. It's a wonderful story. The story of the death, the dying and the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Okay? It goes like this. You know, first of all, we're told, and this is, I did remember to include this. This is something we talked about before. On the day that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi died, the rabbis decreed a fast and they prayed for mercy. They said anyone who said that Rabbi died would be pierced by a sword. Now, I suspect that the word really shouldn't be died, but was dying. Because, you know, that's how, probably a better translation, because you don't want anybody to say anything that might tip things over the edge. Okay, so here's the story. This is the whole story. It's only basically 4 sections. Here we go. Rabbi, and by the way, he's called here Rabbi because he's the rabbi of the Talmud, namely Rabbi Judah Hanasi. Yehuda Hanasi, or Judah the Patriarch, lived in and around the year 200. He is said to have edited the Mishnah. So whenever in the Talmud it says Rabbi Omer, Rabbi said, it's this rabbi. It's not just any rabbi. It's the rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Okay? On the day, so the handmaid goes up to the roof, okay? And she either has a vision or she sees in her mind something very curious happening. The celestials, the Elyonim, the angels, we might say, are praying for Rabbi. And the terrestrials, who are the terrestrials? His students that are down there in the courtyard, they are praying for Rebbe. Literally, they are requesting him. So what does she say? She says, you know, may it be God's will that those below will overturn those above. Meaning that the rabbis praying down in the courtyard will overcome the will of the angels who are praying for him. Okay, so do you get the image?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a great rabbi. He's dying. The angels are praying, come on up here, we can't wait to see you. But the rabbis are praying, stay along, stay back a little bit longer. What does she say? She says, you know, I pray that the Elyonim, that the Tachtonim will triumph over the Elyonim, that the terrestrials will overcome the Elyonim. And then something happens. She sees... how? Because he's suffering from intestinal distress. You know, in the Talmud, it's very, very interesting. Chole me'ayim, intestinal distress was considered the most painful malady from which he would ultimately die. And partly because you also lose your dignity and your running back and forth to the privy. Now, this is the days before interior plumbing, so you're running back and forth to the privy. So there's one more thing you have to understand. In the days of the Talmud, during weekdays, Jews wore tefillin all day long. Now, do you know what tefillin, does everybody here know what tefillin look like? There's a box here, it's wrapped around the head, there's a box on the arm, wrapped around the arm. So you're wearing them all day long, just during the daytime, but you're wearing them all day long. However, when you go to the privy, you have to take them off. So what do? He's coming down from his, from his room. He goes down, he takes off the tefillin, unwraps them, puts them down, goes to the privy, comes back, washes his hands, puts the tefillin back on. Guess what? He has to go back to the bathroom. Takes them off, goes to the bathroom, comes back, washes his hand, puts the tefillin back on. Has to go back to the bathroom. Takes the tefillin off. You get it? You get the picture?
Yes.
Okay, that's the picture. So she sees this. She says, how much, and then what does she say at this point? She says, may it be God's will that the celestials overturn the terrestrials. Meaning what?
His quality of life has gone down.
His quality of life has gone by. This is so painful for him. May the angels win out over the terrestrials. Okay? But what's happening? What's happening is that these terrestrials are praying with all their might. And these are great rabbis, and they're praying, and they're praying, and they're praying for what? For life. They're praying that he remain alive. And there's an impasse. There's an impasse. And so she goes up to the roof. And she takes a vase, and she throws it off the roof. And it lands in the courtyard with a great crash. Hearing the crash, the rabbis stop their praying. Rabbi Judah Hanasi dies at that moment. That's the end of the story.
That's a great story.
Okay. So what's the moral of the story? Or what are the morals of the story?
Break a vase.
Okay, thank you, David. Yes?
Don't prolong unnecessarily.
In fact, okay, that's one like overarching conclusion you can draw this. Great. So I'm going to ask a couple of more specific questions. First of all, what does the story tell us? And there are no clear answers to any of these questions, but I'll ask them anyway. What does the story tell us about the behavior of the rabbis?
They interfered.
You could say they interfered. By the way, is there any explicit condemnation of the rabbis? Are they punished for what they did?
No.
Are they condemned for what they did? No. They're thwarted, right? They're thwarted, but there's no suggestion that they did anything evil, right? They didn't do anything evil. It's understandable, but in fact, it wasn't what was necessary at that time, right? What does the story teach us about the handmaid? Yeah.
Sometimes it's more merciful and
to
allowable
yeah.
to pray for an end to suffering.
Okay. So again, remember the word suffering is in here, by the way. In the Hebrew it's mitza'al, and it's there where it says how much he was pained. Do you see that? He was suffering. And so there seems to be a sensitivity to his suffering by this handmaid. In fact, she's the only human being in that area who really knows how much he's suffering. The rabbis are just praying in the courtyard. They're fine. It's she who sees it, and it's therefore she who really has the ability to tip the balance.
But you have a handmaiden, untrained, theoretically uneducated,
right.
interfering with the rabbis. So isn't she actually acting on behalf of God and making that decision?
Well, the short answer is that she's seen as the real heroine of the story, and the rabbis are seen as perhaps well-meaning, but
self-centered and self-centered.
Not really having the best interests of the person in their minds. Yeah, Wendy, and then Ellen.
It seems like when you talk about the rabbis, that the handmaid had a certain empathy.
Yes.
The rabbi, and
yes.
It seems like a lot of these other rules don't take that into consideration.
What other rules?
Well, I just mean
the rules the rabbis say you should live.
I see. Yeah, I think
that there are these rules that you shouldn't, you know,
yes,
let somebody go, that you should keep them alive, but without really being able to feel or understand what the other, what that individual mm-hmm. is experiencing.
I think what you're saying really complements what Peter said, which is that you have this uneducated handmaid who, in fact, however, is given this sense of understanding that is lacking by the over-intellectualized others who might in fact feel they're doing the right thing. And in fact, you get this sense, and I think that this is partly an answer to the question that was asked before. You know, essentially Laurie asked the question, is it okay to permit to say to somebody, it's okay to die? Or for Carol to say, Mom, you did what you came here to do, you know, please, we're doing okay. And the answer seems to be from this story, yeah, you know, that, and maybe we want to refine, using the story, those two principles. Remember, what were the principles? One was, you cannot hasten death. The other, we said, was you can't prolong dying. I would maybe refine it by saying you can't prolong suffering. Right? You can't prolong suffering. That's clear from this story. Okay, Ellen.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You can't pray for death, but the rabbis, by praying, were prolonging his suffering.
They were prolonging his suffering.
And so the only
way... They were prolonging his suffering.
And they didn't realize it, but the minute they stopped...
By the way, you know, this is one of those key characters in the Talmud that is not given a name. It's really tragic. You know, here she is, this amazing heroine, and she's not given a name. She's the ama, or the handmaid of Rabbi Hunosi. Yes?
On another level, what you have here is the power of prayer. As long as they keep praying, he will live. And as soon as they break that power of prayer, he dies. So on one level, on a different level, and she was praying for his death. That didn't do any good. Her praying for his death didn't hasten his death. It was her taking the vase and throwing it down that stopped their prayers that hastened
this
death.
This is a beautiful story because
so
it really does.
The power of prayer is
very powerful, right?
But only to keep Allah somebody alive, not to pray for death. Praying for death didn't work. You had to stop the prayers for life.
So, very interesting. Very interesting. I'm reminded of something, but yes.
But by their praying for him to stay alive, he was hearing them.
Well, do we know that?
Well, he could get up to go to the privy. Think about it.
Yes, yes.
That's what I'm saying. The fact that he could, if he seemed to me that, I mean, he obviously had typhus or some horrible, you know, disease, but he could get up and take off his tefillin, unless that's symbolic of not.
I think the idea of the going to and from the privy is not so much that he passed by the rabbis and schmoozed with them or anything, but just that he you know, but it sort of, it captures in a very vivid phrase, Just how challenging this time is.
But if he could sense that they were praying for him, let's say, somehow,
mm-hmm.
then he couldn't let go.
Maybe.
That
maybe.
Would be
so right. There's an issue of letting go. There was a hand up.
They didn't tell him to stop having to need to keep the tefillin on. Nobody could say, all right, you're so sick, you don't need to keep the tefillin on. Nobody could say that.
Do you remember that unit from last year? It was last year. You know? Didn't I tell you the story from the... I think it was the opening chapter of Jonathan Safran Foer's book, Eating Animals, about his grandmother in Russia. I read that to you. Remember that?
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
And how she said, you know, how she was starving to death. She was like a pencil. And she came out of the camps, and this Russian peasant offered her some food. And did she eat that food?
No, it was poor.
She didn't eat that food. And what did she say? She said, you know, if your values are not, if you're not there anymore, forget it. So in the same way, the notion, it wouldn't have occurred to the author of this text in the Talmud, well, he could have just kept his tefillin on. That's not a realistic option. Okay. Time is zooming by. And so I think we really should try to pull this together. It's been a very, very rich discussion. Let me say what I think are some basic principles that we can get from the Jewish ethical literature on end-of-life care. Number one is that you cannot hasten death. That is clear, and that's been made clear on a number of occasions.
However, you can remove impediments to dying. Now, the key question is, well, which is it? Which is it? Is throwing that vase over hastening his death, or is it removing an impediment, namely the praying of those rabbis?
That's an easy one.
That's how the text is understood. The text is understanding that to be removing an impediment, clearly. Okay? And so then the question becomes, well, we go down the list. Are the different therapies, are they really caring for the person, or are they in fact impeding that person's natural departure from this earth? And if we understand them, and sometimes we can understand them as impeding the natural departure of a person from the earth, if we understand it that way, then it seems to me these texts can lead, and I'm jumping a few steps, of course, but these texts can lead to the assumption that it's permissible to remove those therapies because they're just impeding the natural process of dying. On the other hand, if in fact, you know, they have a chance of restoring to a person his health, remember, the Jewish mandate to heal comes from a text in the book of Deuteronomy that says, you must, if you find something that your neighbor has lost, you must restore it to him. Right. Anything that your neighbor has lost, if you can restore it, you must. That's the mandate to the physician to heal. Because if you've lost your health and the physician can restore your health to you, then he must do it. But what if he can't? What if he or she, excuse me, cannot restore your health? Then what is he or she doing? If the health cannot be restored, if only the organs can be kept functioning, but life cannot be restored, then what is going on? And that may be a case where one sees the proper way to care for that person to be to no longer impede the dying process. So I'm not suggesting that these are easy. I am suggesting, however, to respond to Peter's question, even though you're absolutely right, and Elliot Dorff, who's written a nice work on end-of-life care, and if you're interested in the whole chapter, I'm happy to send it to you. It's a beautiful chapter, has made it clear, look, you know, these texts come from a world when very little could be done to keep someone alive. Very little. We can keep people alive, but the purpose of keeping a person alive, quote-unquote, the purpose of keeping those organs functioning is to permit the recovery process to occur. Now, we know that can happen sometimes. We know that can happen sometimes, whether it's your father-in-law or anyone else, where people think someone is dying, and in fact, they recover. I had that shocking experience myself once at the New York hospital. I was a chaplain. I'll never forget this. It was so shocking to me. I was brought into a room to see a patient, and the patient's daughter said, oh, please, let me talk to you. My mother is so gravely ill. If she sees you, it'll tip her over the edge. I mean, it's not my purpose to do that. So I spoke to the woman. She asked me what to have. She said, my mother is expected to die within 12 or 24 hours, so please tell me what comes next. So we had a nice long chat. It was a Friday afternoon. The sun began to get close to the horizon. And I said, you know, I'm not the chaplain on call this weekend. The chaplain on call is so-and-so. If you need a chaplain, I do wish you well. And I'll come by to see you on Monday, and I hope to see you on Monday. She said, well, I don't know that that's going to be the case, Rabbi, but we'll see what happens. And I came on Monday, and so the first place I went was rode the elevator up to the, I think it was the 10th floor. It was a very tall building in New York Hospital. Mm-hmm. Came out of the elevator, and as I came out of the elevator, a woman was rushing in with these two heavy suitcases, and behind her was the woman I had spoken to, her daughter, who rushes by me and says, Rabbi, my mother recovered. What can I say? Goes into the elevator, doors close. Boom. Checked out. That can happen. Evidently. So things can happen. On the other hand, as we know, you know, then there are times when it doesn't happen. And my own experience, I should say, has been that in almost every case, you know, what might seem like a critical moment when one has to make these critical end-of-life care decisions, if one waits a few moments, it becomes clearer. And a person has a way of communicating what, in fact, is happening. which direction a person is going. That becomes pretty clear in virtually all of the cases in which I've been involved. And it can be very sad. It can be very, very sad. And it can be very, very challenging for everyone all around. Because it's hard not to think of one's own mortality as well as that of a person whom one is caring for, or perhaps, you know, has been loving for many, many years. And so it's a very, very difficult, but generally we can take our cue from a person. And so autonomy, which we've circled around, remember we began by talking about autonomy, because I felt that the texts really emphasize that. That may be where we end up, with the notion that a person has a right to sort of not dictate, but to sort of give us clues and hints and help us determine which way this person is going, what journey this person is on. And if one allows a person to set that route, my experience has been that that also tends to be one which is a very ethical and a very a loving and a caring one, one where empathy, which we talked about as being a key element here, is allowed to flourish. I wish we had more time to talk about all these materials, but I think that will have to be it for this subject. Next week, we will go on to our next, God willing, we will go on to our next subject, which is about inclusion and the notion of the ethics of inclusivity. I want to thank everyone for coming tonight. And again, if there are any questions, comments, follow-up issues, please feel free to write. Thank you.